order at 2:03 p.m. Wednesday, December 11th. And is co-chair Christ Tompkins online? We're going to take a brief at ease to make sure the LIOs are all connected so that members can connect remotely. We're working on a meeting where some people are calling in remotely. So, could the secretary please call the roll? Well, because we're doing this remotely, I guess I'm just going to note that Representative Story, Representative Vance are online. We have Representative Josephson in the room, Representative Shaw in the room, Senator Gray Jackson, and Representative Christ Tompkins online. Please silence your cell phones. Martha Moore and Juno is taking the records, and our LIO moderator in Juno is Doug Bridges, and Reese Williams is here in Anchorage. So the agenda today is private prisons and prison outsourcing. We have a number of presenters, Chet Atkins, Native Men's Wellness Program, Dr. David Lovell, Associate Professor Emeritus from University of Washington, Randy McClellan, Alaska Correctional Officers Union, Felix Rivera, Chair of the Anchorage Assembly, and Kathleen McLaughlin with Restorative Reentry Services. And thanks to Kelly Good and Laura Brooks from the department for being here to answer questions. So before we get started with presenters, I wanted to give Representative Josephson a chance to make some remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Unfortunately, I'm due to fly out of town now, but I wanted to say hello to everybody. Thank you for coming. I applaud the scheduling of the hearing. I've got staff here who's going to let me know how things went, and I'll likely be reviewing the hearing online as well. And just to note that I share the frustration of many of you. It was actually a previous Republican administration that had said we're going to turn away from sending prisoners out of state. We thought we'd cured that. Representative Fields has a bill that would put the final nail in the coffin, so to speak, relative to that. You know, we thought in the budget that we had made pretty good strides and made our point pretty clear as legislators to wall off funding and, you know, make the case that we needed to reopen Palmer Correctional Center. And there's some evidence that the department, we think, has not done all that it could to reopen that. But I wish you a good hearing and happy holidays.
Thanks, Representative Josephson, and members of the Finance Committee who really worked across caucus and party lines to allocate funding for reopening Palmer Correctional Center. So just to open this hearing, I want to read a quote from Governor Murkowski on passage of Senate Bill 65 in 2004. Governor Murkowski said, and I quote, "I have consistently supported finding a solution to the chronic problem of prison overcrowding in Alaska. Over a decade of gridlock has led to the failure to improve on what was supposed to be a temporary solution of sending prisoners to Arizona. The result has been the placement of more and more prisoners into community housing alternatives and the constant transferring of prisoners between locations to ensure the integrity of the system, all of which runs the risk of compromising the level of public safety being provided to Alaskans. And finally, this bill will generate good-paying long-term jobs for Alaskans and end the export of over $14 million per year to Arizona," end quote. So, with a little of that history of work to incarcerate and rehabilitate Alaskans here in Alaska, I want to turn to Chet Atkins with the Native Men's Wellness Program.
Good afternoon. March 31st of 2015, I was released from a halfway house after doing 2 days short of 28 years in prison. 18 of those years were spent in the private facilities out of state from January of 95 until May of 2013. I got to Spring Creek in June of 88, and the Alaska system has always been considered something of a weak system. By a weak system, I mean that the convict code wasn't embraced as much as it was in other places. What that meant is that, for the most part, sex offenders walked the yard without being molested. The level of violence was minimal. There were fights, but there was no chronic situations where five or six people would roll in on one person and would assault them. I honestly can't remember a single assault on a staff member when I was there. What happened to us when we went to Arizona in January of 95 is we got there and the officers, as we all know, the number one variable cost in corrections is staff, how much you pay your staff. So to make a profit, they pay them as little as they can possibly get away with. When we got to Arizona, staff was making $9 an hour. Kitchen staff was making $5 an hour. You didn't have to turn staff. They would find out what your reputation was and come to you. And that was pretty much how it was from 95 all the way through till we came back in 2013. So there was minimal drugs. There'll always be contraband in a prison. You're not going to stop it. But it was minimal when we were in Spring Creek up to 95. When we got to Arizona, everybody was in on it. They would come in with their cowboy boots packed with whatever you want, because we had money from the native checks. The other thing that happened was, is they say we're housed separately. Well, that's not true. We worked in the kitchen side by side with every other contract that was there. You went out in the yard, and you might be in a separate yard that was fenced off, but you were talking through the fence to other contracts. The first year we got there, it was less than a $600 bed capacity at the Central Arizona Detention Center. The next year, the capacity doubled, and they brought in prisoners from Oregon, and that was where the criminalization of the population really began. We were indoctrinated into the convict mentality. That was the beginning of it. Okay, the gangs didn't start for a little while, but that was where it started. We were exposed to New Mexicans, the Virgin Islands, the American Virgin Islands, from people from there, from the District of Columbia. We were exposed to the most violent people. The people from the District of Columbia were there because they had dismantled another prison, a CCA prison in Ohio. When we were transferred to Red Rock Correctional Center in Eloy, we were housed side by side with California prisoners, a vast majority of whom were gang members, and most of those being MS-13. We were indoctrinated in that, and that's also where the Native Brotherhood was formed, in response to how things that were happening to the Native population from the other gangs. There's always been prisoners in the system, but we didn't have white supremacy in the Alaska system until we got to Arizona. You talk about the 1488 guys that committed the murder last summer. Our being outside for that amount of time, being exposed to things that we were, are directly responsible for that. We were taught by other facilities or other states how to act as convicts. And we were, that was all done under, the guise of saving money. I think that while in the short term it does save money, in the long term it costs a whole lot more, both in money and in lives and opportunities lost. And the thing that I will say is that, when I was taken off the street, I needed to be taken off the street. Okay, I was a danger. But in the time that I was in prison, I saw a whole lot of people come in for the first or second time that who could have been easily redeemed. But because of how our system is set up, they were pushed into situations where they had to become people they didn't need to be. Okay? And not all of that was choice. They had to do what they had to do to survive under those circumstances. Beyond that, I don't know what else to say.
thanks for your testimony. Could you just provide a little additional background on the 1488 gang for people who, and the murder for people who might not have followed that?
From my understanding, well, the 1488 is 14 stands is the letter N for the Nazi party, and 8 is H for Heil Hitler. So they are a white supremacist group that got real strong, especially when we were in Colorado. And I don't know the particulars of what happened last summer, but I know that behind what prison politics and labeling people rats and all this other stuff, somebody was killed. So that's my understanding of that.
Thanks. Do other members of the committee have questions?
Okay. This is Representative Story.
Go ahead, Representative Story.
Thank you. I just wanted to say that I appreciated the letters and the backup information that Mr. Atkins supplied, and for him advocating and speaking up. Thank you very much.
Well,
thanks for being here, Mr. Atkins. Mr. McClellan with the Alaska Correctional Officers Union, could you come forward and offer your testimony?
Good afternoon. My name is Joshua Wilson of the Alaska Correctional Officers Association as well.
My name is Randy McClellan. I'm the president of Alaska Correctional Officers Association. I'm also a staff sergeant with the Department of Corrections. I've been employed since 97 with the department. Today, we're going to give a brief history of some of the ills of privatization, the negative history, a little bit of personal experience with it in DOC. I was here when the inmates were outside, and I was here when they came back, and saw firsthand a lot of the negative effects the private prisons had on our offenders. First off, why privatization? It's hard to believe we're less asking this question these days after all the bad history with Alaska and in the lower 48. Alaska has already fallen victim to corruption by private prisons and their lobbyists. In 2007, then Representative Tom Anderson was convicted of 7 felonies, including extortion, bribery, conspiracy, and money laundering. That alone you would think would be enough for us not to be having this discussion today. Profiting from the incarceration of our citizens is downright unethical, and sending our hard-earned Alaska money out of state to line the pockets of private prison shareholders is ludicrous. The public has voted down privatization in Alaska 4 separate times over the years. Anchorage in 97, Delta Junction in 99, Kenai in 2001, and Whittier in 2005. In 1994, then DOC Commissioner Frank Pruitt signed a contract with Corrections Corporation of America to house 200 prisoners in Arizona. This was a temporary solution to alleviate overcrowding in Alaska prisons. By the end of 2007, when the contract was transferred to Cornell Corrections Corporation, that population had soared to approximately 1,060 prisoners. By the time we brought the prisoners home, this temporary solution lasted nearly 20 years. In 2012, we opened the Goose Creek Correctional Center to bring home our prisoners to take care of our own and put them closer to their families and their cultural rehabilitation. In 2018, even President Trump signed a bipartisan bill that requires federal prisoners be incarcerated no more than 500 miles from their primary residence. Any out-of-state prison Alaskans could be sent to would far exceed 500 miles. Starting in the spring of 2013, we started getting our prisoners from Colorado back. Right away, we were getting back. We realized we were getting back a much different prisoner than we had sent out. They are far more dangerous and skilled in criminal ways. Many, including inmates, have referred to the out-of-state private prisons as criminal college or gladiator school. I don't think this sounds like rehabilitation to anybody. I think we heard just a few examples of that here just a moment ago. These prisoners came back organized into three different primary gangs, now validated in Alaska, as the Lowlifes, the 1488, and the Native Brotherhood. In essence, Alaska created these gangs by sending incarcerated Alaskans to out-of-state prisons. Prisoners are forced to join these gangs for protection. There is safety in numbers. Even those who had never had a desire to join a gang are forced to join for safety. When these prisoners came back to Alaska, our use of force incidents spiked inmate on inmate and inmate on staff, assault soared, drug trafficking hit an all-time high, and is still a problem. When I first started with the department, we had very few gangs, very little gang activity. From time to time, a gangster would come up from the lower 48, try to organize or try to get his business started, and local PDs and the correctional people were very good at exposing them and making it real hard for them to do business, and usually they went home or they went to prison, and they rarely got a foothold in Alaska. Now we have hundreds, or maybe more, gang members in our facilities and our communities. We specifically train officers how to identify gang members and their activities. And although there are many other gangs, our focus is on the predominant ones in Alaska, the Lowlifes, the 1488s, and the Native Brotherhood. Again, the three gangs that we created by sending these prisoners out of state. If a prisoner doesn't feel safe, we can't seriously expect they'll be able to rehabilitate or better themselves. If we want to be the example and provide programs and cultural programs to better these people, and then with hopes of reintegrating them back into our society, how is it a good example to put them at harm's way on a daily basis where they don't even feel safe to leave their cell to go down to a parenting class or an anger class or a drug rehabilitation class? They're not going to do it. They're just going to survive until they can get out as soon as they possibly can. State prisons keep prisoners from their families. They're unable to even make phone calls due to exorbitant long-distance fees. Cultural programs offered for rehabilitation are virtually non-existent. Alaska offers a number of cultural programs. The Native community, they do potlatches. I know in Kenai they smoke fish. They bring in cultural foods. There are a number of things that only Alaska could provide. None of this would ever be accomplished out of state. And there are statistics after statistics that show that the family connection and cultural connection is primary in rehabilitating our offenders and putting them back into our societies better than we received them. The reason given for the necessity of sending prisoners out of state, private prisons, by this administration has been a spike in the prison population and a shortage of correctional officers. The spike in the prison population, on an average, from the time the governor signed the crime bill to today, is approximately 213 prisoners. That spike, as statistics would show, has at this time plateaued. Anybody can predict where it's going to go, but we have seen where it's gone so far. Although it's not a perfect scenario, but that spike certainly isn't a crisis at this point. That's putting us at about 97% capacity, as the department reports. The increase in population and deficit of officers is no surprise, and it's certainly nothing new. During the last legislative session, the administration was very aware of this problem, and it was discussed on numerous occasions in session. Commissioner Dahlstrom has stated several times that recruitment and retention is her top priority. Unfortunately, their efforts so far have netted them a gain of minus 26 officers since Governor Dunleavy was sworn in. The reality is they've put forth no effort to recruit because it goes against their narrative to privatize corrections in the state of Alaska. Overtime is soaring, safety is compromised, officer burnout is real. Just today I was having a conversation with a correctional officer from Spring Creek Correctional Center who stated that every off week he is mandatorily working 3 12-hour shifts minimum every off week. He works a 7-12 shift, that's 84 hours, and then he does 36 more hours on overtime. That's minimum. Some do more. Some work 16-hour shifts. Anybody can see the burnout there. Recruitment intention couldn't be of more importance. The commissioner is right in that. It should be a priority. But talk is cheap, and we have yet seen the results of a robust recruitment and retention program. In Commissioner Dahlstrom's letter to the legislator dated December 6, 2019, she outlines the cost of reopening PCC. She estimates the cost to be nearly $40 million to reopen PCC. This is a building sitting idle. Heat's on, electrical's on, plumbing works, sitting there idle, ready to populate with minor upgrades and maintenance. Could it open up tomorrow? Probably not. 4 months? Could we open medium? Likely. 5 months. Maybe 6 months. This is something that could have been attempted or started well before now, well before we had this conversation. Maybe nearly a year ago when it was realized that a new crime bill would raise the inmate population, and at that time, realizing that we had a shortage of correctional officers. Making it a priority to hire and retain correctional officers was a great idea at the time. We're many, many, many months into this at a now, quote-unquote, crisis. And again, we've netted a minus 26 officers since Governor Dunleavy was sworn in as governor. The $40 million to reopen Palmer, although I'm not an expert and I'm not a contractor, I have worked at PCC. I've worked at many facilities in the state of Alaska. Seems crazy to me. I know correctional officers that are at PCC nearly daily since it's been closed. They take inmate work out there. We know that it's in far better shape than a $40 million price tag. Just for a comparison, the Anchorage Jail, which was some years ago, the state-of-the-art facility, Anchorage Jail, was constructed for $58 million. You're telling me that an existing building is going to take $40 million to reopen? Again, I'm no expert, but that doesn't sound right to me. Somebody should probably look into that. I think you may be being misled. In closing, I'd just like to say Alaskan correctional officers are the best in the nation, period. Our rehabilitation programs are of the best in the nation. We have an empty facility. It was one of the largest program facilities in the state. Our incarcerated Alaskans have their best opportunity to rehabilitate and reintegrate into society here at home. We should be taking care of our own. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. McClellan. I guess I just say before going to questions, to me, correctional officers are the often forgotten heroes in our society who are providing frontline public safety services to Alaskans and, you know, it's not as obvious as seeing a patrol car go by from APD, but it's every bit as important. Do members of the committee have questions for Mr. McClellan? I do. So, Mr. McClellan, you were around when Goose Creek opened up and staffed up. And internal documents from the Department of Corrections suggest that they could open PCC's minimum facility in 5 months, the medium facility in 9, or both in 12. Just talk about what you saw when Goose Creek opened up. Obviously, a much larger facility. My understanding is the department hired hundreds of officers as they staffed up. Could you just talk about how that happened in the time frame to open, again, a much more massive facility?
Sure. The exact numbers of officers, I'm not sure. I know that they hired 100 and some officers in a short amount of time, less than a year, to start Goose Creek. I'm sure if they could do it then, they could do it now. Goose Creek was opened up in kind of stages, kind of like we suggest with Palmer, on a smaller scale. You know, they started with local prisoners that they pulled from existing facilities, kind of a test phase, working out the bugs, and then started opening up at a section at a time. And the following spring, they started bringing back the larger groups of prisoners from Colorado. And that's exactly what we think could be easily accomplished with PCC. You know, if we don't have the staff currently because there's been no push to recruit or hire staff, start now. If there is a crisis, let's start now. We have a facility sitting there where we can put this increased inmates, and we can start manning it and start opening it a portion at a time. Another comparison on the recruitment subject is, this has been such a priority for this administration to recruit and retain correctional officers. I can appreciate that motivation, but in comparison to the troopers who can't rave enough about their successes in recruiting and getting qualified applicants and filling their ranks, I read newspaper articles about it. I go to the airport. There's live trooper TV 24/7 going on. I read Fish Alaska. I love fishing. I open it up, and there they are, having fun in helicopters and snow machines, higher on with the troopers. I mean, that is a priority to them, obviously, and they have succeeded in that priority, and I'm happy for them. Those are my brothers and sisters in blue. I mean, I'm pleased. I want to see them get more. I mean, they need all the help they can get on the street, and I know they hope the best for us. They want the same thing for us because we interact continually. They come into our facilities daily. And they see the problems we face. And we would like to maybe mimic the process that they did. If it worked so well for them, let's try it.
Representative Shaw has a question.
Yes. Do you know if there's a backlog of applicants for corrections positions?
I don't know that for a fact. I would hope that there are some people in what they call the hopper waiting to come in. But
And maybe we could... turn to Ms. Good with Department of Corrections after this, Representative Shaw, to answer that question. I did have one other question for you, Mr. McClellan. You said that when prisoners were shipped outside, they joined gangs out of necessity for self-preservation. Could you talk about, in private prisons outside, how effectively gangs and criminals come to run the prisons because they're so understaffed and because... the private prison companies run them with such poorly paid employees, and how people have to, you know, join gangs out of what they feel like is the necessity of self-preservation. What is that environment like in these outside prisons that probably most of us in this room have not experienced?
It's kind of like it's warehousing prisoners. They're the private prisons are in it for profit. So cutting costs at every corner makes sense to them. They want to put as much money in their pockets as possible. They're in it for the money. Much unlike Alaska, who we're in it for our citizens. They're in it for the money. So the fewer officers they can hire, they save money, less qualified. Alaska correctional officers are Alaska Police Standards Council certified. We go through rigorous training down there. I'm kind of joked, you have a pulse or fog of mirror, you got a job, come on in. And they don't make much money. As we heard earlier, they make money in other ways. They're prostitution and drugs and phones and you name it. And there's few of them, and I'm sure they're fearful and corrupt at the same time, so they probably hide out as much as they can, and it's the Wild West in there. They just let the prisoners take over. And, you know, not all prisoners are bad. I mean, there are some really bad guys in jail, obviously. Some made a simple mistake. Some are young kids and had no direction, had a bad family situation. You can't categorize all these guys as bad, but they're all mixed together in this large group. And the bad ones, the heavy-handed ones, become the leaders. And And oftentimes they form these gangs for business, and sometimes they form them for protection. But the guys that are in there that are just trying to better themselves and do their time and get back to their families, if they don't join the gang that they need to join will take advantage of them, and the other gangs. I mean, they absolutely have to do it for protection. And once they're in it for an amount of years, and it takes a lot to get them out of that once they come back here. Sometimes they're not permitted by the gangs to get out so easily. I've talked to some prisoners that have gotten out, some that have tried, and maybe it's an old movie saying, but blood in, blood out. There is some reality there to that. So those are the problems we face when we get them back here. And the question is always, what are you going to do about recidivism? Why, if we do it so well in Alaska, why do we have a problem with recidivism? That's something we were always working on. It's something we'll never stop working on. But those prisoners were out of state for 20 years. 20. We haven't had them back 20 years. We haven't had them back that long, really, in perspective. It takes a little time to work through things. I think we've seen some progresses. I think the programs that we've have in place have seen some successes. Given time, I think we could really drive those numbers up. Drive the numbers down for recidivism, success rate up.
Thanks again, Mr. McClellan. If other committee members don't have questions, perhaps we could hear from Ms. Good on Representative Shaw's question.
Representative Fields, I have some questions when...
Representative that, Story.
Thank you for the information. I wanted to ask if there is a timeline for training for correctional officers that is standard, what that timeline would be, where they had adequate training for the skills of the job. So that was one of my questions. The other question has to do with the budget that's outlined to get Palmer facility open at $40 million. I am wondering if there is a budget for that and backup for those projected numbers in the costs needed. And then the third question is, in that projection, does it include having the programs that were discussed in some of the letters we received for behavioral and addiction health treatment and the education programs? Thank you.
Okay, I'll address the training first. I'll assume you're talking about Alaska correctional officers training. When a correctional officer hires on, they are on an FTO program, field training officer program, where they have an officer assigned to them to train them, teach them, monitor them, do weekly evaluations. That lasts, I believe, for about 12 to 14 months, and they will attend an academy. Shortly after they hire on, they'll attend an academy. That, how many weeks is it? Let me forget. Two and a half month academy, I think. And it's rigorous training. For anywhere from physical fitness, drug identification, gang identification, some hand-to-hand tactics. I would say that the Alaska correctional officers are far better trained than most correctional officers across the nation, probably in the world. As far as the money for Palmer Correctional Center, I think there's $16.8 million set aside. Could be off on that 16-something. I think it's
16.7.
Ballpark set aside to reopen Palmer Correctional Center last session. I think that would be, in my opinion, more than enough to get a portion of Palmer Correctional Center reopened. And I'm sorry, you'll have to remind me the rest of that question. I know there was two or three parts to that.
Sure. And I guess my question was if there was a budget, and of course you might not have that, but I believe the Department of Corrections would, whoever made the estimate for what it would take to open the facility, if there's probably numbers and there's probably backup rationale for those projected numbers. So I would like to see that at some point. And then also I wanted to know within that budget for opening the Palmer Center, does that budget include having those training and addiction treatment programs?
Well, perhaps, so Representative Story, we could now go to Ms. Good from Department of Corrections to answer that question, and also Representative Shaw's question. And then having answered those questions, we can proceed with the invited testimony. Thanks, Mr. McClellan, and to the correctional officers for being here.
If we have time, we would like to touch on some of the RFP, if that's at all possible.
Sure. Yeah, we could do that, and then get to the questions for the department.
Do you want to do that? Okay. My name is Joshua Wilson. I've represented correctional officers in the state of Alaska for about 7 years now. Over the last year, I've looked into private prisons extensively and looked into the RFP proposed by the Department of Corrections here very closely. And I guess the biggest thing I want to debunk is that this proposal will not save money. This is going to cost the state money because of the many hidden costs that are associated with this RFP, with sending people out of state with using private prisons. To start with, as Mr. McClellan touched on, is increased recidivism. Contact and visitation is crucial to reducing recidivism. Florida study found that inmates receiving visitors were 31% more less likely to commit another crime. I mean, that's huge. That's 30%. Less of those individuals committing another crime, creating another victim in our communities. And that has a price, too. It's a best practice to keep people close to home. Obviously, the federal government's doing that now. A lot of other states are looking to do that now, and we should as well. In regards to programming, the RFP itself will not provide the same level of programming. It only requires the prior prison to offer 3 vocational programs. The state of Alaska currently offers 12. So, I mean, that in itself clearly shows that we're not going to be offering the same. Plus, the program that we have in Alaska is fairly excellent in a lot of different degrees. 2017 Alaska Justice Information Center analysis found that we're doing an excellent job, and of 8 Alaska programs reduced recidivism between 20 and 26.3%. And they estimated that every avoided conviction for an offender who committed a felony is anywhere between saving between $100,000 and $150,000 per conviction. So, I mean, we're talking about significant dollars here when you're looking at reducing recidivism. Another thing the RFP is going to do is it's going to lengthen incarceration. 2017 Mississippi study found that people incarcerated in private prisons are incarcerated there up to 90 days more than they are in state prisons. Well, every single day that they have a bed filled in a private prison, it's helping their bottom line, and it's hurting the state's bottom line. Punishment is determined by Alaska judges and Alaska courts. Private prisons should not be allowed to increase their profits simply by writing inmates up in their prisons and keeping them there longer. Another thing the RFP allows the private prisons to do is cherry pick their inmates. One of the ways that private prisons shift costs to the state is that they only pick the medium, minimum prisoners that are easiest, that are cheapest to hold. Already the RFP, they've put out an amendment, they're going to exclude everybody who has serious medical conditions. So Alaska keeps those. Also, they've contemplated excluding sex offenders as well, also an expensive population to keep in prison. This is a trick that private prisons use to inflate the cost to the state while trying to show that their numbers are cheaper. Another negative effect, which is clearly clear from the RFP that we're going to have, is we're going to have reduced safety and security for our inmates that are incarcerated out of state. The clearest example of this is the RFP only requires Alaskan inmates to be counted every 4 hours. That means 6 times a day. In Alaska, prisoners are visually observed by correctional officers a minimum of 45 minutes. That's 32 times a day. So our minimum standard that we say must have to keep inmates safe, the only thing the RFP requires in terms of counts and checks is every 4 hours. They're also not required to be an American Correctional Association or National Commission on Correctional Health Care accredited for 2 years. Why would we allow our inmates to be held in a facility that's not accredited for 2 years? I don't know. The RFP also sets extremely low standards for training and experience. Only 40% of the security staff are required to have a minimum of 1 year in law enforcement or in corrections. There's also no requirement in the RFP that the security staff meet the same standards we have here for Alaska correctional officers, that they be Alaska police standards qualified or equivalent in the RFP. Another major expense is going to be medical expenses. The RFP says that The state of Alaska will pay for the cost of all off-site medical expenses under $250 and emergency and emergent services. Under this language, the private prison could regularly send inmates out for anything that's under $250, and we're going to pick up the tab for that. Transportation is another huge cost. The RFP shows that we pay the transportation costs. And I guess one thing I want to clarify is these are all costs that I'm explaining that are not in the per diem rate. So you're going to have your per diem rate under this contract, but these are all the costs on top of the per diem rate. To give you an idea how expensive the transportation costs can be, my understanding is that when we brought inmates back from Colorado back to Alaska, it cost us about $2.3 million. That is an extreme amount of money to move people back and forth, and we're going to have that same cost when we're sending people out of state now. There's also a significant number of administrative costs, including background checks for all private prison visitors, autopsy and body disposition in case of a death, all review of all classifications still has to be done by us, all of the probation and in bringing them back has to be done by us. So there's a significant number of administration costs as well. Additionally, in the RFP, we're going to have to continue to take the litigation cost, and these can be massive, especially from private prisons. We're going to have to defend all post-conviction litigation and challenges for people being held in private prisons. And maybe one of the biggest hidden costs is that we're going to lose Alaska jobs. We're going to be sending money out of state, and we're not going to be seeing a return on that money. And we're going to have an increased crime, and that obviously means more victims, more Alaskan victims. And that's not only Alaska in our communities now, but those are the people who we're sending to these private prisons. And the state expects these costs to go up. The RFP anticipates that we're going to have placement adjustments, different rate for additional beds, and that the last time we had a private prison contract, the price went up nearly every single year. So we have to expect that that's going to happen as well. The state put out an amendment already to their RFP, which further reduced the standards by which we were talking about. They gave up the authority to approve or disapprove private prison management staff. They tripled the period the state must give to terminate the contracts. They decreased DOC oversight by loosening requirements on what employee records the private prison is required to give. They've removed stricter requirements for the private prison to complete a financial audit by an independent certified public accountant. They no longer have to do that. They removed the requirement the private prison provide post-secondary education. They have also said that they don't have to staff specifically pre-release, pre-entry transition programs, designate specific people for those programs on their own. So there's nothing to stop the DOC from further reducing these standards as well. The Alaska statute requires that we take care of those who are incarcerated in our institutions. It also says that we will not send people out if we cannot get better rehabilitative treatment for those individuals. Clearly, from the testimony you've already heard, we are not going to do that, and we cannot do that under the way this RFP is written, because private prisons have such leeway to do less than what we require of ourselves here in Alaska. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer those as well.
Thanks. And just for committee members who may be following from LIOs or online, question 38 in the DOC RFP response, which is in your packet, The vendors asked, if the department does not intend for the contractor to provide tutors, supplemental instructors, or other individualized educational services as support for prisoners who opt to enroll in college courses, will the department agree to delete the second and third sentences of the subsection? DOC responds, yes, meaning that they will not be offering those post-secondary services. Question 44, again, just for members who are following along online, The potential vendors ask, can the state clarify if there is a requirement to staff the pre-release reentry transition program with academic or vocational instructors? And DOC's response, which I'm not going to read completely here because it's very long, essentially says no, that'll just be staffed kind of on an ad hoc basis by whoever the guards happen to be. So what we've seen here from the RFP is there could actually be zero post-secondary training at these private for-profit prisons, which is extraordinary to contemplate. Does anyone else have... Actually, I have one additional question for you, Mr. Wilson. So, you know, here in Alaska, when inmates are preparing to reenter the community, some of them do work release programs, seafood processing, other private employers. They can save some money, improve that transition back into the community. Is that important for an for someone returning to the community to have work in your experience to avoid recidivating? B, I'm assuming that these for-profit private prisons have zero record with employing folks returning back into the community here in Alaska. Could you address that?
Certainly, vocational programs, work programs are very valuable because, especially depending on how long an individual spent time in prison, getting back into the workforce can be very difficult. Having the training necessary to be able to do that is vitally important, and it allows them to have a smoother transition back into the community. In regards to what a private prison will or will not give, a lot of it will determine on what the intent proposal that the DOC announces and what exactly is that contract will look like. So, unfortunately, I don't have enough information to answer that.
And I was late in acknowledging Representative Hopkins is online. In addition to Co-Chair Christ Tompkins, Representative Story, Representative Vance, and, of course, Representative Shaw in the room. Does anyone else have questions for Mr. Wilson before we go to DOC to answer some questions that have come up during this part of the hearing? Okay, thank you, gentlemen, and thanks to all your members for their service.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thanks, Ms. Good, for being here today.
Thank you.
So I think the first question was from Representative Shaw.
The question was the backlog of applicants that may be there.
So do you want me to go on the record? Are you okay?
Sure, if you can put yourself on record, thanks.
Kelly Good, Department of Corrections. Representative Shaw, what's happening right now is we have people through different phases in the application process. Right now we have 45 that have been given a conditional job offer. Now they have to go through the medical testing and stuff. So of that, we, on average, about 30% will make it through the next phase of testing. So there isn't necessarily a backlog. It's that applicants are following different phases through the process.
So what you're saying is that there are 45 that have potential to be correctional officers, and only 15 of those may make it? 30%?
Correct, due to the testing. So we have psych testing and medical at this point. That's about the average that we see that make it through.
And from what I was reading, we're short about 90 correctional officers in the system?
That's correct.
Thanks. And Representative Story, I think, had a question about the cost to reopen Palmer Correctional Center, and I've got some questions about the two. Representative Story, did you want to restate your question for Ms. Good?
Yes, thank you. I was wondering if there was a budget available that outlines the projected cost to reopen the facility and backup for that rationale for the projected cost, and does that include the addiction training, the addiction treatment programs, and the career education programs?
Thank you. So I want to reference the letter that the commissioner sent to all the legislators this week. Reopening Palmer Correctional full facility is just a little over $28 million, $28.7 million. That does include the substance abuse she's referring to. I did not bring a breakout of that. We worked with the facilities folks in order to put this is also the cost that would staff it, right? So it's not only the one-time capital projects that are needed in order to get the facility ready, but it's also then the operating costs. So I don't have a breakout, Representative Story, but I can get you something, no problem, and I can supply that to the chairman and they can distribute that to the committee.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Representative Story. And I guess I had a follow-up question. So a previous DOC breakdown of costs for Palmer Correctional Center had cost to reopen the minimum security facility is $9.8 $8 million in a 5-month timeline. Cost of the medium facility, $14.4 million, 9-month timeline, and timeline to reopen both facilities, $21 million and 12 months. Could you explain the discrepancy between the this kind of breakdown versus the numbers in the letter?
Absolutely. So the numbers that you're seeing there don't necessarily include the one-time capital projects that have to be done to bring the facility ready. So that's just something that's missing there. Timeline, we actually had our facilities folks go out and look to try to determine how quickly things could get done. So the numbers in the letter are the most current and the most accurate we wanted to provide you. So this is something we're looking at all the time. And so it's just a matter that this is the most current in front of you. As far as opening one side or the other, it would always be best to look at opening the medium side, if just so that that's on the table, that it gives us more latitude in housing. Minimum would only be able to house minimums, and medium we could put medium and minimum there. So that's why the letter, I think, only dealt with the full facility and then the cost of the medium side.
So again, this DOC breakdown says if you were just going to reopen the medium facility, it's a 9-month time frame. I guess my question is, why didn't the department start that when the legislature appropriated $16 million, which, according to these numbers, would be enough to open the medium facility? I believe that budget passed in April, so, you know, we would be most of the way through 9 months right now if the department had just started that when the money was appropriated. Could you explain that decision-making process?
Sure. I think it comes back to the commissioner's letter, which is, it's not an either-or issue, right? This was about an immediate issue, immediate population management crisis that was, we saw building. The difference is that we can't staff it. And I know there's discussions about recruitment, but the department has an active, ongoing building recruitment program. And so that's really what it's about, is that the commissioner did not feel like it was a responsible move to open Palmer when right now, statewide, we're 90 short. Mr. McClellan mentioned about the overtime. That's happening in our facilities today. That needs to be addressed first. Our current staffing needs to get stabilized. We need to fill some of those open positions first before the commissioner was comfortable opening a brand new facility, which was just going to stress the system additionally.
Representative Wool is online. Thanks for joining us. I don't want to monopolize these questions. Do other members have additional questions for Ms. Good about the considerations in reopening PCC?
This is Rep. Story. Yes, so when you talk about being short on staff, what has the commissioner felt should be done to get our staff ready to go? The shortage and the need, future need. There is a shortage. What is stopping us? What is needed to address that shortage?
Thank you. I don't know that there's a simple answer. I mean, I think we have to try everything. The bottom line is reported in the newspaper recently, unemployment's at a low for Alaska. So that means our workforce is a smaller pool to draw from. And we need qualified applicants that make it all the way through the system. Like Representative Shaw was mentioning earlier, we really only will see about 30% that will end up passing all the tests and taking advantage of conditional job offers. So right there, that's a challenge to the department. But we have we are constantly recruiting. We're recruiting statewide. We're recruiting nationally. We're attending job fairs. We're working with the Department of Labor to identify other areas and ways to seek individuals and reach individuals that might be interested in becoming a correctional officer. We're using social media, and we're open to more ideas. fields. I mean, the commissioner is constantly looking for ways to seek new applicants. And I will say one thing that is evident is that, yes, Alaska has a shortage, but nationwide there is a shortage of correctional officers. We are not the only state facing this issue right now.
Well, I have a question.
Go ahead, Representative Story.
I know that I don't know what the pay is compared to national pay and what is needed to be adjusted for a cost of living. Has the commissioner been looking at increasing that incentive, which seems to be working for the troopers?
There was a recent, I believe, pay increase in the recent union contract. I will say that we are looking at all different kinds of incentives right now. Yes, that is something that we are definitely looking at to see if there's something that would work.
Okay. I
have a question.
Oh, sorry, Representative Story. Go ahead.
This is Representative Vance.
Oh, hey, Representative Vance, go ahead.
Just to follow along that train of thought, since we only have a 30% success rate in the applicants, do you see any hurdles that could be amended for having a higher success rate? I don't want to lower our standards for who we are going to have because it is a position that requires so much regarding public safety, but are there things that we could do to reduce some, loopholes to help have a higher success rate in people being able to qualify and raise that 30% higher?
Thank you, Representative Vance. So I want to clarify one thing. That 30% is dealing with the group that has a conditional job offer. If we look at applicants as a whole, it is lower than 30%. On average, just shy of 10% of those that apply actually go all the way through and accept a job at the end. So I just didn't want there to be confusion about that stat, about that number. Are there ways that we could make some changes? We're actually looking at that because there are some regulations that are there that may, over time, may not be as relevant today that we're looking at. There's an age requirement, whether or not 21 needs to be the age, whether or not we could accept somebody younger is one thing that other states have looked at that's being discussed now. Then there's some other things that regulation and statutory are kind of guiding us, that yes, definitely we want to look at and see if there's some changes that keep the quality and the fine officers that we have today, but also open it up a little bit for more to take advantage. So yes, we agree, and we're trying to identify those right now.
Okay. Well, if no one else has additional questions for Ms. Good, I guess I'd just say in closing, I'm somewhat confused by the discrepancy between this March cost breakdown from DOC, which says the cost to open PCC minimum and medium facilities is $21 million versus the commissioner's more recent letter saying that it's nearly $40 million. It's a large difference, and the department's own sheet says that minimum facility cost to open $9.7 million, medium facility $14.4 million, cost to open both $21 million. Presumably, the department actually incorporated the capital cost when it estimated cost to open, and I just remain confused about how we could have such a large discrepancy.
So the letter's 28.7, not 40. I don't know where 40 came from.
Well, the 40 million is the 28.7, and the letter also says if DOC is not granted the authority by DOT, then the anticipated capital costs will be 11 million. So
we would hope that DOT would give us the authority to run the project. Representative Fields, okay. That was just for informational, because that does happen sometimes, and if that happens, then there's a cost associated with DOT running a project, and that's a cost outside of our control. So that was put in there just for information so that the dollars were in front of you.
Okay. Is there a date at which the department intends to start the process of reopening Palmer Correctional Center, or has that happened?
So I think that the answer really is about staffing. We can look at reopening Palmer and what we can do with it as soon as we know that we could staff it so that and take the burden off the current shortage that we've got right now. 90 officers short across the state just isn't okay. And we know that. And so before we open a whole nother facility where we have to staff it at safe numbers, the commissioner is committed to filling some of those open vacancies now and then being able to look at Palmer.
Okay. And finally, we discussed the RFP earlier. Is that still out on the street? When does the department anticipate awarding that?
So the RFP closed. And it is now just starting. It's under procurement, and so I can't speak about it at this point. But it's closed, and the procurement process will take. We'll go through the steps now.
Okay. Thanks, Ms. Good, for being here and
sure,
answering questions, and to other department staff who are here as well. Let's go to Felix Rivera.
Mr. Chair, I had a follow-up question for Ms. Good.
Okay. go ahead, Representative Story.
Yes, I was wondering if the commissioner has considered asking for a supplemental for the 90 staff, incentives for pay increases or whatever incentives you are looking at, and also for the staffing that would be needed to keep our citizens who are incarcerated in state.
Should there be a need for additional funding, the commission would always work with the governor's office, OMB, and the legislature on any supplemental. At this time, I don't have anything that I know that to bring forward to you, but yes, that would always be the process she would follow.
Okay. Or maybe to narrow that question, the legislature already appropriated $16 million. If DOC's current estimate for the cost is $28, are you preparing a supplemental for $28 minus $16 for the remainder that we have not yet appropriated, according to your current estimate, to open PCC?
So I go back to, unless it can be staffed right now, the commissioner is not looking to open it unless we can staff it.
Okay.
This is Rep. Story again. I need to clarify my question, because my question was, we have a critical need for 90 more staff people now. So my question was, when you're looking at incentives, if we know we need to have funds to increase pay, training, whatever, has there been consideration to put a supplemental for that? Because that would be in addition to what was already planned.
Thank you, Representative Story. If incentives, if identified, could not be paid for out of the current budget, then yes, the commissioner would come forward, work with OMB and the legislature on a supplemental or a request. That would be the process. We would first look to see if it's something that we could pay for within the existing budget.
Representative Fields, this is Representative Grace Tompkins. Question to be put in the queue.
Go ahead, Representative Chris Hopkins.
Yeah, my question is about I think it was a floor amendment that the House voted on earlier this year. I think it was like a 29-6 vote that removed language that had made its way through the budget process. I think existed originally in the governor's budget proposal that may have allowed DOC to send prisoners out of state. When that was identified, there was a floor vote to remove that language, and the floor debate was, you know, quite clear. Basically, does the legislature, as the appropriating body, support the DOC funds being used for out-of-state prisoners? And I am interested in Ms. Good or the department's perspective on basically how you all view that vote and perceive the legislative intent associated with that vote. Vis-a-vis actions and policy going forward.
Thank you, Representative. So in the end, I don't believe that language was in the final bill, but I know what you're referring to with the floor amendment. I think it's, not wanting to speak directly for the commissioner, but this is my understanding, is that she understands the need and she understands the desire of many to reopen Palmer, but that is one issue. Here we're dealing with two issues, really. We're dealing with population management, a current number of 98% population in our facilities. We are understaffed, so overpopulated and understaffed. And so when you take that, it was her belief that the responsible thing to do was to issue an RFP. So in the event that we are in a situation that we will become at 100% max, that there is a safe manner to house all of our inmates. That said, that's separate from Palmer, because Palmer isn't ready to open today. It could be a brand new facility, and we still couldn't staff it. So she totally appreciates and understands the legislature, and she honors all of you as she has been there. But when she looks at her job of providing safe and secure confinement and a safe working environment for people, this came down to her believing that this was an avenue she had to take in order to meet that priority. So I think it's she referenced it in her letter as, people are saying an either or, and what she's saying is it's not an either or. It was a how to handle this predicament at this moment. And she did so in the most thoughtful way possible.
I have a question, Mr. Chair, when you're ready. This is Rep. Wall.
Go ahead, Representative Wall.
Thank you. I've heard this phrase, it's not an either or. Does that mean it could be concurrently? In other words, you could look into an RFP while at the same time reopen the facility and aggressively address the hiring problem that you have. And by the way, you mentioned unemployment as one of your issues, but Alaska has the highest unemployment rate in the country, almost double the national rate. So our low unemployment is not the issue here, I don't think.
So the either or, Representative, I would say we are actively trying to recruit and fill those positions. And so if there were enough correctional officers to lessen the burden on our current staff in our current 12 facilities, then it would be something the commissioner could definitely look at with Palmer. So yes, I do agree that it could run concurrently, but right now we first have to start filling those existing vacancies.
And a follow-up, what's the timeline if they decided tomorrow to reopen it, and how long would that take? And could you also envision a situation where if the system reached 100% capacity, if they had to ship people out, it would be temporarily until the Palmer facility was opened and staffed?
So on average, our facilities folks have said to get Palmer up and going is around 12 months. I mean, we could look at ways of trying to speed that up, but that's what they have been telling us. That's just an average. The second question was about the RFP and bringing it back. Can you repeat that part?
Well, let's say it takes 12 months to open the facility and you start tomorrow and you aggressively start staffing it, because it'd be hard to hire people for a job if there's no facility where they're going to work. So you do that, and then in the next 12 months, if we go over 100% capacity and we have to ship some prisoners out, after that 12 months, in theory, you could bring them back. Is that correct?
In theory, yes. I mean, that's what the commissioner would look at. I'm sure if that was on the table, yeah, we would look at that.
And I guess what's stopping them from opening the Palmer facility, even though it would take 12 months?
Staffing. The commissioner does not feel comfortable in our staffing levels right now. She doesn't feel like it would provide a safe environment.
Even given 12 months to hire the people?
That is due to the fact that we're 90 short right now system-wide. That's not counting Palmer. Palmer would require, full facility requires an extra 74 correctional officers, not counting other staffing. So we're 90 short system-wide today, 74 additional if you brought Palmer on. So she really believes that we first must relieve the burden on our current staff. The overtime is real, and the only way you can do that is to hire and fill some of those positions first.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, I appreciate Representative Wool's comments. I guess I would just go back to when we opened Goose Creek. I believe the state hired 108 officers in 10 months. The department's own numbers from March estimate opening just the medium facility would be less than the $16 million that the legislature has already appropriated, and could be open and could be done in 9 months, and has the capacity to cover all the additional prisoners that are the result of the passage of the crime bill. So I guess I would just reiterate what I think Representative Wool was saying, which is that why would we not start taking the steps now to open at least the medium side of PCC? Because obviously the longer we wait to start, the longer we wait before it's ever open. And I worry that we get stuck in the position of sending people outside for years and years while we never start reopening PCC, because we're always stuck with a challenging recruiting situation. But thanks again for being here. And I think in the absence of further committee questions, we're going to go to the next presenter, Anchorage Assembly Chair Felix Rivera. And if you could just state your name for the record, thanks for being here.
My name is Felix Rivera. I currently serve on the Anchorage Assembly. I represent Midtown and serve as the chair of the Assembly. Representative Fields, Representative Christ Hopkins, and honorable members of the committee, thank you for inviting me to speak before you today. To be clear, I am speaking here in my capacity as an individual Assembly member and do not speak for the body on this matter. The municipality of Anchorage has a long and firm history when it comes to private prisons within city limits. As was mentioned before, in 1997, an effort was taken by the Alaska State House to approve a contract to build a private prison in South Anchorage. Then Assemblymember Bob Bell, representing South Anchorage, led a push for a public vote on the matter. The plebiscite led to an overwhelming 2-to-1 margin against the idea of a private prison in South Anchorage, which led to the Alaska State Senate withdrawing support for the measure approved by the House. Since 1997, I am confident in saying that the opinion of the residents of the municipality of Anchorage has not changed on this matter. In fact, I would say we have dug even deeper into our opposition for private prisons. This antipathy and a report I received from the Alaska Correctional Officers Association in early summer led me to conduct research and public outreach on private prisons and what the Anchorage Assembly could do within its legal powers as a home rule city to prevent the opening and operation of private prisons within the municipality. Unfortunately, because Alaska operates under a unified system of corrections, the Anchorage Assembly has little purview to regulate the operation of private prisons within our boundaries. That is the sole purview of the legislature. This led me to crafting the resolution the Anchorage Assembly is considering and will have before us for a vote on December 17th. This resolution resolves, without equivocation, that private prisons should not operate within the municipality of Anchorage, that the state should not contract with private prisons either within the state or out of state, and that the Assembly opposes placement of Alaskan inmates out of state. The resolution, in its whereas statements, understands that the Alaska Constitution is clear in its mandate that criminal administration should be based on the, quote, principle of reformation. Understanding this constitutionally mandated principle, the resolution further states that private prisons or sending Alaskan inmates out of state does not fulfill this constitutional duty. Fiscally, private prisons have not been shown to save money, but rather to increase costs over time. In this current fiscal climate, I believe it is prudent that we carefully take these matters under consideration. Additionally, experience from other states with private prisons have shown that these operations do not reduce recidivism or prepare inmates for reentry. Again, going against the constitutional principle of reformation. In fact, research has shown that inmates placed in out-of-state private facilities return with increased gang affiliations and a greater propensity for a, quote, criminal mindset and violent behavior. The Anchorage Assembly and Mayor Ethan Berkowitz have made public safety a top priority. We've added over 100 sworn officers to our police force and worked to prevent certain crimes. These efforts are beginning to show successes, with many types of crimes reduced by 25% or more over the last 3 years. The operation of private prisons within the state of Alaska, or sending Alaskan inmates out of state, would contradict and could even reverse the progress made on public safety within the municipality. To close, I want to again thank this committee for inviting me to speak on the proposed resolution the Anchorage Assembly will be considering on December 17th and encourage the legislature to act on the issues outlined in this resolution. Thank you.
Thanks, Chairman Rivera. And if committee members don't have questions, we'll now go to Kathleen McLaughlin with Restorative Reentry Services.
Thank you. My name is Kathleen McLaughlin. I'm the owner of the Restorative and Reentry Services. I'm testifying today to discuss the community impact when using private prisons as an opportunity for incarceration. Restorative and Reentry Services, I travel around the country to look at trends and behaviors related to criminal justice reform and reentry services, and particularly community-based reentry services. What I find somewhat ironic is the trend in the lower 48 right now is to avoid the use and to sunset the use of many private prisons. Currently, Denver is sunsetting the use of private prisons in Denver. California is doing the same. New York State has just determined that it's going to close Rikers and instead have community-based correctional facilities in New York City. The trend that is a national trend is that warehousing inmates does not reduce recidivism. But instead, what does reduce recidivism is the level of normalizing individuals while they're incarcerated so they're ready to return into the community as a healthy individual. With respect to that, prior to opening Restorative and Reentry Services, I had the pleasure of being the director of the Partners Reentry Center for 5.5 years. And during that time, we were able to meet 8,500 of our reentrants. The ones that were the most successful in our program were those that we touched prior to release from incarceration and began working with them on pre-release plans so that when they did ultimately release into the community, there was what we would call a soft handoff. It is the relationship building that you would lose if you were to decide to just ship people out because the relationships would be broken. There's a couple examples of how the community has helped to restore people while they're inside. One of the examples is the Lullaby Project. Totally community-based, no cost to the Department of Corrections, agreed to by the Department of Corrections. And it is a music therapy program that Shirley Maystadt started 4 years ago. The importance of this is that we as musicians, and I was honored to be one of them, was able to go into Highland to pair up with women who were either long-termers or young mothers who could create a musical song of some sort in order to honor and to respect either family members or other people in the community. I was very, very lucky to meet a 32-year-old woman who just received a 99-year sentence with 39 years suspended, and we wrote a song. The point is, she's been already in for 6 years, and I was able to build a healthy relationship with her, along with all the other musicians. There is a running program at Highland where community members come and run with individuals, females who are incarcerated, and many of them are long-termers. The key to all of this is relationship building with the community is equally as important as anything else. When you start thinking about moving people out of the state, those connections are absolutely lost. There is a study from the University of Minnesota that said that relationships with community and family, healthy family, is one of the key determinants of if somebody is going to recidivate. If you are asking people or sending people out, the connections are lost. And so when they come up, there isn't just a flip the switch that they're in prison and then they're released there isn't some moment where it's just a recognition they're going to be healthy members of society. What can help, instead of thinking that there is just this moment where everybody's going to behave when they get out, is if they have relationships with healthy individuals. So when they get out and they have a few hiccups, they have someone to turn to. And by taking pockets of our Alaskans out of state, we are once again eliminating the ability for them to build healthy relationships. The other piece, I was also lucky to do some work at Spring Creek. They have a restorative justice program down there. They're all long-termers. The goal of these long-termers were to be good role models and to assist those that were releasing. That is a cheap way of normalizing an institution. By using long-termers and their services and their motivation to have a purpose, because everybody wants a purpose, as good role models for people that are going to be releasing. I think it is just, just as an example, with community funds, one of our UAA professors, Dr. Frank Jeffries, went into Spring Creek about 2 years ago and created the Nonviolent Conflict Resolution class. Of the 35 people that started it, 27 of them graduated, and they are now creating their own train-the-trainer, where they have morals and ethics classes that are taught by long-termers. If these are the long-termers that are going to be shipped out, the changes in the culture in which we already are starting to build in our Alaska prison system would be eliminated or minimized. With respect to, there was one other question that kept bothering me, and that was, do people spend more time in private prisons than they would if they were not in a private prison, but in a public prison? There is a study from the University of Wisconsin-Madison that was done, and I think it was alluded to by Mr. Wilson. And it specifically showed, with data-driven evidence, that people were spending more time behind bars that were assigned to private prisons rather than public prisons. They also had a higher recidivism rate when they returned into the community. Is that what we want? It doesn't make sense to me. And then the final point that I wanted to make is, 38% of our prison population approximately is Alaska Native and are primarily rural-based. 18% of our state population is Alaska Native. So the Alaska Natives in our prison system are overrepresented. Culturally, if you send them that people that have a rural Alaska Native heritage down to Arizona or Colorado, and you introduce them to societies that they don't understand and are not understood while they're there, they are going to bring back bad behavior. When I was at the Partners Reentry Center, I can tell you the impact of learning bad behavior in the outside prisons was resonating with Alaska Natives that were on the street even to this day. And for us to be sending people away to learn bad behavior and then bringing them back without reentry tools, what do we say? And finally, it's really interesting because in Montana, Core Civic is one of the private prison contractors. For whatever reason, many people were trying to seek reentry into Alaska in order to get into our reentry programs here from Montana. And during that process, I was able to talk to Core Civic quite a bit. The attitude within the walls of a private prison is far different than one in which the community is coming into the institutions and building relationships. And nobody came from Core Civic from Montana for a variety of reasons. But I think the point is, they're looking for solutions, and it's not within them, their corporations, because of the mentality of warehousing versus giving people dignity and respect in order to move forward in their life journey of releasing and becoming healthy members of the community. So with that, I'm willing to take any questions at all.
Thank you, Ms. McLaughlin, for your testimony. I think our final invited witness today is Professor Lovell. Professor Lovell, are you online?
Yes, this is Professor Lovell. Thank you for inviting me here. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. Please proceed.
Oh, yes. Okay, well, let's just proceed with the first slide then. The rest of the first slide. Go to introduce myself. Let's go to the next line. My name is David Lovell. I'm retired from the University of Washington, the Department of Child, Family, and Population Health and Nursing. My title is Research Associate Professor Emeritus. The fact that I have a PhD in philosophy and a master's in social work, and I'm in a school of nursing, should give you some clue that my career has not necessarily been straightforward. In fact, I've been around quite a bit, and I want to be sure at the outset that perhaps to set aside or any misconceptions you might have about listening to an ivory tower outside expert. That's not me. I don't want to play that role. I've been working in prisons, outside prisons, with prison system prisoners for over 40 years. In the community, coming out of prisons, on their way in jails, in treatment programs, in light prisons, in women's prisons, in tough prisons, and nice prisons. So what I'm basically offering you is the benefit, not just of my research, but of my experience of how prisons work. And I hope you will not make any assumptions about me based on this, based on my position. I think criminal justice has been wrongly represented as a partisan issue, and I very much appreciate the fact that the Alaska legislature has attempted to take a bipartisan approach to this problem. So I'm not sure if we moved on to the next slide. Go ahead, next. Can we move forward? Okay.
So, Dr. Lovell, the first slide is up.
Yes. Yes? Okay. I can't tell whether the slides are moving very well. Yeah, just go ahead next.
All the slides are following, so you can just continue along, and we have someone advancing the slides.
Okay. All right. Okay, so you'll follow along with what I'm saying. Okay. So, the other thing that I'm not doing, besides telling Alaska how to solve this problem, is adding more information to the record of fraud, abuse, concealment, violence, and litigation in private prisons. Your previous expert witnesses have laid that out, have done a fine job of that, both Mr. Wilson and Ms. McLaughlin, and Mr. Rivera, the ones that I've heard so far. My primary argument is basically this, which is that for Alaska to develop its own capacities is the right thing to do. And next. That outline will proceed in three steps. Basically, there are three points that I want to make here. First, the private prisons are not legitimate. And the concept of legitimacy that I'm introducing here is a very important concept because of the fact that we are actually punishing people. We talk about reform, we talk about rehabilitation. Those are very important goals to pursue, but the fact is that people are there because they are being punished, because it is our judgment they've done something wrong enough to warrant their being taken away from the community until they learn their lesson or until we feel safe. We're making a moral judgment in that act, and it's very important to maintain the legitimacy of what we're doing, if we're going to have any success. Programs, yes, all kinds of programs can be successful. The most important thing is that the people delivering the program are believed. Second point, sending people out of state is a sign of a policy failure. This is not
This is not an uncommon policy failure. I don't know a single state over the last 40 years that has not experienced that same kind of problem. I was in California when massive reforms were undertaken, and I was working those details, working for a county, and some people were prepared to handle the situation, others were not. Some jails, like the ones where we were prepared and people worked together, were able to handle the predicted influx. Others were, oh no, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? What are we going to do? I don't know what properly characterizes the Alaska legislature, but the fact that you're in this situation means somebody, somewhere, failed to do adequate planning, and not out of stupidity or greed, but just because it's a very problematic, difficult situation of criminal justice. And you're responding to the things that are happening across the country in that respect. The conclusion, therefore, is that keeping state prisoners and state public institutions is doing the right thing. And that's basically the argument. The problem is, so what? We know what the right thing is. That doesn't necessarily mean we can figure out how to do it. So my final point that I want to emphasize here, and this has already been supported by previous speakers, is Alaskans can solve problems themselves by working together to do the right thing. And I'm saying that partly because I know a little bit about Alaska. Although my own family is an old New England family, one of New England's oldest families, I married into one of Metlakatla's oldest families and spent my first year of retirement in Ketchikan. And what a welcome change it was from California. So I have a lot of affection for Alaska and its people and the way they conduct themselves. Next slide. Private agencies may provide legitimate and useful services. Even in a clear case of nepotism like mine, I really got my primary start learning how to work with prisoners from my uncle, who was working as a private contractor in a prison, providing a service to inmates, counseling them, getting them to understand who they were and why they ended up where they were. And this was 40 years ago. I've also seen in many cases of community members and professionals building programs together. Seattle Mental Health, which sort of broke the logjam of where mental health treatment agencies in the community were sort of afraid to treat mentally ill prisoners. The Dangerous Mentally Ill Offender Program that Washington State started, and which my colleagues and I were involved in evaluating, was one where people from different agencies who were coping with the same problems, mentally ill, addicted, people on the streets with no help for them in the hospital, not being able to take them anymore, they had to figure out a solution. And working together, they did. And I've seen that also, by the way, in prison situations as well. Even for-profit agencies, those are usually nonprofits, but even for-profit agencies can provide useful services. Pioneer Human Services in Seattle is a long-term example. It's done many good things, created many opportunities, employed lots of ex-offenders, but it's always a mixed bag. There was a program in Napa that I evaluated, also for-profit. It was later swallowed up by GEO. The building that was housed in was hit by an earthquake. So we don't know how it turned out. But I've also seen the other side of it. At Napa, we developed a way of analyzing our jail population. We needed some help with it. SAS came in, gave us a half-hour presentation. We're going to solve your problem for you. They didn't even pay attention to what the problem was. Same thing happened again at another agency. We're going to take care of your problems. We're going to sell you the solution. People bought the solution. It wasn't a solution. It wasn't what they needed. The critical factor here is whether the focus is local, whether they know who you are, but otherwise, you know, given that record, it's not surprising that in one of my experiences, talking to a superintendent at the Shelton Correctional Facility, he drawled, "We sick dogs on consultants," and you can understand why. So, private agencies may provide legitimate and useful services, next, but not private prisons. Next. Are you with me so far? Is there a question? It's a little bit hard to know what's going on with no feedback.
Sounds good. Please continue.
Yes. Okay. Not private prisons. Ample evidence that you've already seen reviewed shows fraud, abuse, violence, and litigation. The question that we need to ask ourselves is why? Well, we've seen several general answers. First, the profit is the motivation, not performance. Look at salaries, look at the lobbying efforts, look at the bed use issue that is brought up in public facilities. To the extent that you have any options whatsoever, and good policy always leaves people some options to deal with overflows of how to release the least serious cases first or earliest, things like that. In Napa, there's ample motivation to develop those solutions, and people work together to do it in a way that did nothing threatening to the public. Because the incentive there is you'd rather not have more people in prison. And God help us if we let our policies be influenced by large national corporations that actually have an incentive to keep more people longer. That's exactly the wrong kind of incentive that we'd rather have applied. The other thing is that litigation, where people are abused, where they don't follow the rules, we've seen ample evidence that litigation is treated simply as a cost of doing business. We will save money now, understaff, ignore inmate complaints, ignore their treatment needs, ignore the training needs of our staff, and hey, if we're caught, we'll pay later. It still ends up being a cost of doing business rather than something that they see it as their job not to do. That is, their job is to protect people, not to make profits from them. Finally, their protection from public disclosure requirements, which in state agencies, I've experienced this myself, it can be very troublesome having to answer all those kinds of questions. And some people will come up with nuisance questions, but the fact is that you are still accountable, you know you're accountable, and you know you better not be doing things that you won't be able to explain later when citizens and legislators ask questions. This is a general problem. Accountability is already a problem for prisons anyway. And I'm not saying a bad thing about prisons or prison officers, but saying it's just an issue because of the very nature of prisons and the role they play in our society. They're constrained, as you're hearing, by their budgets, by the state sentencing laws. So they find themselves coping with situations they can't control, and they're the only agency that can't send their tough cases elsewhere. Second, prison systems are managing a high-risk situation, and courts have generally deferred to officials' judgment about how to do so. These problems are aggravated by placing a layer of corporate interest between us, our representatives, and what happens to prisoners. As we have seen in the reports we cite, abuses have gone unchecked, private prison corporations have tried to hide the evidence, and opportunities to pass the buck multiply. The problems, however, that have been documented with private prisons are not procedural kinds of problems like they could, if we just develop better policies, put requirements on them, somehow they could somehow get better. The problems are fundamental, not procedural. Next. What are the differences between, what is the critical difference between private and public operation prison facilities that explains the findings that have been reported by your witnesses so far today? It is true that some conditions, understaffing, overcrowding, affect all prisons. The risk of violence and abuse of power is inherent to prison. Hence, there's no shortage of horror stories. A book about Walla Walla Prison, which I know quite well, visited many times, and have friends there among the staff. There are stories about what was going on 20 years ago, 25 years ago. They're terrible. But what I have seen described in Mississippi, in those private prisons, is something that could never have happened. at McNeil Island Federal Penitentiary 40 years ago. It couldn't have happened at Bridgeport Correctional Facility 35 years ago. It couldn't have happened at Summers, the maximum custody facility in Connecticut. It couldn't have happened even, it couldn't have happened at Walla Walla. It couldn't happen at the King County Jail. These things should not happen anywhere. And when they do happen, they're a sign not just that training, there's a sign of a fundamental breakdown in this system. That the system fundamentally is not committed to meeting the legal and constitutional obligations that apply to people who are carrying out legitimate criminal punishment on behalf of the people of the state of Alaska, the people of any community that finds it has to lock people up for their own good or to punish them for what they've done to us.
Dr. Levels, if you could try to wrap up, I do want to make sure we have time for public testimony because I know there are some people in the room waiting for public testimony.
So I'll go right ahead then and just tell you the rest. It'll take another 5 minutes. So the question then is, on whose behalf are the staff exercising their legal and constitutional obligations? The answer is we the people. We adopt a democratic form of government to protect our rights and freedoms. We understand that the benefits of social of mutual cooperation and trust are only available to the extent that people will not intrude upon us, not try to take our stuff, not try to hurt us, not try to beat us up, not to otherwise make our lives miserable and insecure. We also understand that to the extent that we are unprotected from that, and we feel that we have no recourse but to protect ourselves, that private vengeance and bloodshed will result. That's why we feel that we have a duty to obey the law. We trust that criminal punishment is the most severe power the government exercises. Amendments 4 through 8 of the Bill of Rights all deal with criminal punishment. Search and seizure, due process, speedy public trial, no excessive bail. Public servants are bound by oath to respect our rights. There's the DeShaney principle, which said while people are in the custody of the state, you have a duty to protect them from harm. In that, corrections officers, mental health staff, everyone who works in prisons is united in that duty. And along with that, it goes maintaining a safe and secure environment for inmates and staff. We place the duty to punish under public authority because we understand that people are imperfect and may abuse power unless private motives are curbed. Second, it follows from that the profit is no legitimate motive for exercising the power to punish. And therefore that private prisons undermine the rule of law and legitimacy of criminal justice. For that reason, developing capacity in Alaska is the right thing to do. It's aggravated by the fact that we're shipping people out of state. Who cares about what happens to our people when they're a continent away? Alaska, will be shipping them not just across the huge state, but across the continent. To whom should their families address themselves if they hear their sons being coerced into joining a prison gang? Their daughter is being sexually harassed by staff. Their mentally ill brother is being held in solitary confinement rather than treated. Is their suffering included in an analysis of the likely costs of keeping people here rather than sending them to a private facility in what is perhaps, especially for Alaska Natives, an entirely alien world? Here lies the greatest potential for lasting damage, not only to prisoners, but to Alaskan communities. There's always an official reason for a failing policy, and there's usually an alternative. Say it again. Alaskans can solve their own problems if they work together to do the right thing. And if you want any further examples of what I've seen inside and outside prisons where people set their minds and they realize they have to do the right thing, we have to solve this problem, I can provide them. Meanwhile, thank you all for your time and for giving me the opportunity to let you know what I think.
Thanks, Dr. Levels. This time, I'd like to go to public testimony. Is there anyone in the room who would like to offer public testimony? Okay, please come up. Yep, so I see Teria Vanden Verk, Eugene Haberman, And I believe Vary D. Suvero is online. I'm not sure if Ms. Suvero, D. Suvero wants to offer public testimony. Is Ms. Vanden work? Yeah, come on up. you actually can both sit there. And I have Ms. Vanden Verk listed first, and you can actually go ahead and offer your testimony. And then Mr. Haberman.
Time per person?
3 minutes.
Okay, I have a timer.
Okay. You can actually sit down.
Go ahead. I'll wait.
And please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Taria Vandenherk, and I am a restorative justice consultant and coach. I'm also formerly incarcerated. And I'm also married to the founder and former leader of the Low Life Prison Gang. I've known him for 20 years. I knew him before he went to Arizona, and I've seen what the private prison does to somebody while they went down to the prison system after he came back. I'll tell you that the stigma being married to somebody that's a former gang leader is extremely difficult. He retired from his gang in September of 2015, and since that happened, it's been extremely difficult in trying to get him into programs or to for him to be able to have the same access to rehabilitation as the rest of the population. Also, being married to him, it's very difficult getting him out of that criminal code thinking. Even though he's no longer in the gang, he still is. He tells me constantly that he has to live by the prison code that we have here in Alaska inside our prison system. I just wanted to kind of go over some stuff that I think that I don't know if you guys already know, but we do have already privatization within the state of Alaska. These are not prisons, but they're corporations. GEO Group runs our halfway houses. Securus is the company that charges for phone calls. 4 years ago, that was implemented, and it is a huge cost on those that are outside trying to talk to their family members inside. And if they're poor, they don't get they can't really get phone calls from their loved ones. DOC received $1.2 million already this year in kickbacks from Securus for these phone calls. So I wonder, in my own mind, while we are trying to focus on not sending people outside to private prisons, what are we also doing inside our own institutions, and what's happening inside our own institutions with staff and the those that are incarcerated? If we really want to see rehabilitation, we should be focusing on the rehabilitation of those that want it while they're incarcerated. And I will tell you personal firsthand that the time that my husband was most successful was with the past administration, with Dean Williams was the commissioner. My husband was able to get into the TLC program, which has a 28% success rate, recidivism rate, 28% recidivism rate versus the state's recidivism rate at that time, which was 67%. Since this new administration has come in, they've shut down that men's program and shipped them out to a pretrial facility where they are sitting in a pretrial facility, and they're not accepting people back into the program at this time. My husband was in that program, and he was a graduate, and that's the time that he did the best. Starting in November of 2018, I started sending emails in regards to him being able to go straight to RSAT, when the new administration came in, they said that they were not sending people to the inpatient treatment program at Wildwood, which my husband was required to complete RSAT. So he requested to go to Goose Creek where he would be able to get into the IOPSAT program, which is outpatient. And I contacted the superintendent, and they said that they would put him in the sober living pod and that he would be able to apply to do the Barber College because that was his desire. None of that happened when he reached Goose Creek. My husband relapsed. He was put back into general population, forced to live by the code that the prison system or the inmates are how they live. And he's not been able to get access to going to RSAT. And he's even requested many times to be sent to an inpatient program. At this time, I don't want to try to get too much into it, but I think that we really need to be focusing also on what's happening inside our institutions in the state of Alaska. And I am in constant contact with people that have loved ones that are incarcerated. March 10th, I got a message stating that a female staff member was walked off Goose Creek property for having an inappropriate relationship with somebody incarcerated. They put that inmate in the hole. September 8th, I got another message stating that another staff member was walked off the property for having an inappropriate relationship with somebody currently incarcerated. In April, my husband's picture was used by the Alaska Correctional Officers Association to stating that Alaska or private prisons created them. And now they're Alaska's problems, and they put it all over social media, not talking about anything that my husband did. So if we're really focusing on rehabilitation and what we're doing, instead of, like, hurting people's... This is what was sent to legislation and put all over social media. And I did screenshots of the officer that put it on social media, and it just happens to be the officer that's recently had a civil action against him for two female inmates at Highland Mountain. I have email after email.
Ms. Vandenberg, if you could try to wrap up, I just want to make sure we get through all the public testimony.
Okay, well, I just want to say that I have a lot of stuff here, and we really need to be focusing on rehabilitation more than anything and not sending people outside of prisons, because now I am seeing what the result of that is. But I also think we need to be focusing on solutions here in the state of Alaska to reduce what's going on inside our institutions. And I think maybe body cameras would be a great solution for that, and having dogs so that drugs are not getting into our facilities.
Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Haberman, and I believe we have Tony Cortez, James Steer, and Robert Redlinger, who may still be here. So please begin.
Well, before I begin, that was 7 minutes. You said three, so what's the story?
Well, I would appreciate if people could try and keep their testimony to 3 minutes.
Okay, I'll do my best with respect. My name is Eugene Carl Haberman. I live in the Valley. I follow the public process when the public process is done appropriate decision made by the governing body. It's more like a public interest. No, I've been in Alaska for over 4 years. Approximately half my years I've been resident of Anchorage, and I'm currently a resident of the Valley for approximately 20 years also. I have been here and as an Alaskan witness the history of what we've done and allowed prisoners to be sent outside. But today, I didn't hear any mention about why we brought them back and who ordered that. I thought I remember the courts ordered that. Maybe I'm mistaken, but there was a strong reason that we need to bring the prisoners back home. This is our responsibility, not another state's responsibility. It needs to be here. And by separating the people and moving them outside, it's making it harder for those people to be connected with Alaska. They're thousands of miles away. So that's one point. The other point is this. This issue is not new as far as how many people are in prisons in Alaska right now, occupancy. We, if I understand it, and please check this because I'm not hearing it, we have been over capacity for some time. Those prisoners, I was received reports, but please check it. I may be wrong. I'd like to know, someone say, is this true or not? Have we not been over capacity for years? And that overcapacity has been allowed to the buildings that had set for 100% have allowed more by changing the design of the buildings inside to allow more prisoners to be there in a very unsafe manner. So I appreciate someone checking that out, because this is not new, and this is not just this governor's lack of responsibility, but it's a responsibility that goes back to other governors, in all respect. Second is this issue. There was a comment made about a resolution by Anchorage, and that you heard it about the 17th. That resolution was on the consent agenda on the December 3rd meeting. Their consent agenda does not allow for public comment. They put these resolutions there, and the end result is there's no chance for the public to say anything unless they send emails, and who can see those emails? Can the public? So to the 17th meeting that's noted for that resolution that Anchorage has taken a position on is 2019-434, and there's an S version and S1 version, but it's still on the consent agenda. And if you read it, it says a note that says, makes it sound that there was hearings, but there wasn't any hearings. They don't comply with the basic state law, which provides a reasonable opportunity for public to be heard. So now here, with all due respect, I'm glad what you're having here is a discussion and allowing public comment. But the municipality of Anchorage does not do that with that same respect. There's not even a second of time for the public to be engaged. And I also make a note here is, you see, I'm a bridge in this community and the state, in that I not only have a connection with what's going on in Anchorage and I've lived many years there, here, but I've spent a number of years in involvement in the borough. And because of that knowledge and what's going on both sides and my continued traveling almost every day between here and the valley and being involved in these meetings and seeing what's being said and what's not allowed to be said, I'm more familiar and I go to the microphone so that the public can hear what's not, that their rights have been violated. So again, thank you for having this meeting, and I hope you could have other opportunities. And just one last point, too. I'm concerned about this scenario, and I didn't fail to mention it, and it was came to mind in the beginning, was this, that is the situation right now that the governor right now can send prisoners outside because there's no legislature. What have they done today, this meeting, and how many Alaskans right now are outside the state? What are the numbers there? With all due respect, thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Haberman. And actually, as I'm looking at the sheet, I realize there are three additional people who signed up saying they would not like to testify. So is anyone remaining in the room who would like to testify? Okay, please come up to the chairs. And actually, two people can come up and you can take turns testifying.
Dr. Phil, to my question, Mr. Ask question, Ms. Good, is that...
This is probably not the appropriate venue to do that. You can state a question as public testimony, and it'll be in the record if you'd like to do that. If you could introduce yourself.
Good afternoon. My name's Robert Redlinger. I'm a retired correctional officer from Spring Creek. I reside in Anchorage. My question today is, Ms. Good had stated, and I wish the committee would follow up on this, that we're short 90 officers. That's true. I get calls every week from my former place of work, Spring Creek, officers stating the amount of overtime they're working. Now, how long have we been short 90 officers? Has it been... And what institutions, a breakdown? There needs to be a breakdown of this from when Commissioner Dahlstrom took the position to now. Has the trend been going up? And they mentioned that incentive programs. Well, years ago, I spoke to former Commissioner Dean Williams, former Commissioner, Deputy Commissioner Claire Sullivan about incentives. That was 2 years ago, 2.5, 3 years ago. Why aren't we just talking about it? let's put some rubber on the road here and do something, because we know we have an issue. Thank you, and good day.
Thanks, and we can follow up with the department with questions about the trends. Ms. Stampas, if you could put yourself on the record.
Thank you. For the record, my name's Triada Stampas. I'm the policy director for the American Civil Liberties Union of Alaska. You've heard a lot already about many of the concerns regarding private prisons and outsourcing prisoners out of state. We share all of those concerns. And I've submitted written testimony that goes into far more detail. I just want to point out in this room that another issue with private prisons and prisoner outsourcing is that it fails to address one of the main drivers of overcrowding in our prison system currently. Currently, about half the prison population across the state is unsentenced. That's largely a population that is in prison without any conviction, awaiting trial, or between court appearances. And the current RFP that the Department of Corrections has issued is for long-term sentenced inmates to be sent out of state. It does nothing to address what has been a 20% increase in the unsentenced population in our prison system just in the past year. And the biggest proportion of that increase in pretrial admissions has been among nonviolent misdemeanor offenders. And so what has happened increasingly, and especially over the past year, is that people who are arrested, and again, arrested, not convicted, for nonviolent misdemeanor offenses are finding themselves admitted to jail more and more often, and that has been an enormous driver of overcrowding in our prison system. And so I appreciate and support this committee's use of its oversight authority to look into this issue of private prisons and prisoner outsourcing. And I encourage you to extend your focus to what the main drivers of prison overcrowding are, because this isn't even something that will address that. And so there is this other problem that is creating this burgeoning crisis of overcrowding in the prison system that, whether it is sending incarcerated people out of state, which I think the consensus here has been is a very bad idea, or reopening Palmer, a focus on pretrial, neither one of those addresses the burgeoning population of people who are being held pretrial without any conviction. So thank you very much, and I hope that I've not gone over time.
Thanks, Ms. Stampas. Is there anyone else who would like to testify? Okay. Seeing none, I'm going to close this hearing. We're adjourned at 4:07.